Welcome to Harlow on Healthcare. I'm David Harlow, and I invite you to join me by my virtual hearth as I sit down with healthcare leaders to discuss building the future of healthcare. Today, my guests are Michael Fraser, PhD, CEO of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, and Mark Levine, MD, Vermont's Commissioner of Health. Dr. Fraser has held senior leadership positions in other healthcare-related organizations and has served with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Dr. Levine practiced as an internist and has had a career in academic medicine at UVM as well. Welcome, gentlemen, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Certainly. So I'm a recovering regulator myself. I was deputy general counsel at the Mass Department of Public Health back in the early 90s when David Mulligan was commissioner and our current governor, Charlie Baker, was the state secretary of Health and Human Services. So I have a longstanding interest in public health. Across the United States, we are now experiencing something like 130 opioid overdose deaths a day from both prescription and illicit opioids. There are certainly a wide variety of responses to the opioid epidemic. And as always, we're dealing with 50 laboratories. And the two of you wrote a piece that was published recently in the Annals of Internal Medicine, laying out a framework for an outcomes-based public health approach to the crisis. I very much liked your image of the silver buckshot approach, as opposed to looking for a silver bullet. What are the complexities of the problem that demand the silver buckshot versus the silver bullet approach?
The opioid crisis really is one that has so many manifestations, so many causalities, is interrelated with so much going on in the country now with what we term diseases of despair. The CDC just came out with a very timely report showing we're now in the third year of consistent decreases in longevity, and view that obviously as a public health crisis because most of the increase in death comes from substance use disorders and suicides, the so-called diseases of despair. So it's really a critical time for public health to partner with communities in prevention work. But at the same time, one can't just focus on prevention because there are people dying every day, as you pointed out, and we need to have treatment systems that have capacity. We need to have harm reduction strategies that allow people to remain alive and up until the point that they themselves realize treatment is in their best interest and accept treatment. We need to have great strategies to keep people in a healthy recovery. So we really felt that it was time to really put down on paper what we viewed as an element of a comprehensive public health approach to this crisis. So spanning the continuum from education and prevention through treatment and recovery and harm reduction, and the kinds of operational strategies one need in terms of using data, having great epidemiology and surveillance, and leveraging that data to achieve the outcomes that are desired, and using traditional public health strategies of engaging leadership and working in partnership and collaboration with a whole variety of sectors. So a very complex problem that requires a very complex and comprehensive set of solutions.
I would just add the complexity of the opioid crisis is one that kind of makes it feel so overwhelming to people. Dr. Levine's being really modest. The approach that we took in the article is really based on a pretty comprehensive program that they had established across the state in Vermont. And he came to Washington to present what they're doing in Vermont to his colleagues, other state and territorial health officials from around the country. We convene them in D.C. often. And I was so taken aback by the many different strategies that they had used in Vermont that I said to Mark, we've got to get this out to more states. And it built upon some work that we had been doing at ASTA, the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, where we were looking at state plans across the country and realizing that while there was so much activity and interest and urgency in addressing the crisis, no one state had actually checked all the boxes in terms of a comprehensive approach. And certainly from the perspective in Washington federally, there's some dominant strategies specific to prescription reduction and monitoring through PDMP, making treatment more available, medication-assisted treatment more available for folks, and also looking at overdose prevention through the distribution of naloxone. All three of those are pretty significant federal priorities. And the all really important work, as Dr. Levine mentioned earlier, but there are so many other pieces that come into play here when you look at addiction and substance misuse. And what's really driving our opioid epidemic is an epidemic of addiction. And we really need to have that conversation in the U.S. and think about what's the public health approach versus the clinical approach, which is just a piece of the response.
Right, absolutely. The federal government recently awarded about $1 billion in state grants addressing the opioid crisis, mostly through SAMHSA. The feds had a 5-point strategy in issuing these grants, which seems to overlap with the 6-point approach that you describe in your annals piece. Could you compare and contrast a little bit? Let us know where you think the emphasis needs to be placed, or is this something that's going to vary from state to state? How would state officials and individual practitioners or institutions understand when different strategies need to be implemented? Or are there some must-haves? You mentioned PDMP, which seems to me to be pretty central. And you know, just wonder if there are other things that are equally central. And I should say PDMP is a prescription drug monitoring program.
Your earlier comment around the silver buckshot approach is really important. And that was a driver of this piece that we did together. And what I've seen federally is some great attention to a specific set, as you mentioned, 5 priorities, most of which have to do with really secondary and tertiary prevention. So one of the things we really paid attention to in this article was primary prevention. And that's a piece that I would certainly love to see more of from the federal leadership level, but certainly states are also doing a lot of work in this area to look at how do we help folks in communities become resilient and not turn to substance misuse, but instead look for other options and, you know, ways of dealing with stress or some of the other predictors of addiction.
And I would add that one of the very positive things the Association of State and Territorial Health Officers has highlighted and made a best practice is an opioid dashboard, the concept of a dashboard that each state would adopt. And if you think about what is a dashboard and what are the kinds of outcomes we want to see and that are really the priority outcomes, clearly the one that rises to the very top is a very measurable quantity, which is the rate of death from unintentional opioid overdose. And so that obviously drives a whole bunch of strategies because that is the horrifying statistic that has been called out so often. But then moving on to other kinds of dashboard indicators and significant outcomes, you'd clearly want to reduce the supply of prescription opioids. And that's where rules about prescribing come into play, as well as having prescription drug monitoring programs. You want to make sure that the state has some level of capacity to treat people. So who's involved in treatment? How many people with the disorder in a state are actually getting medication-assisted treatment in a timely fashion? And are marginalized populations, such as those who might be incarcerated, also having access to the same treatment? Are there prevention programs, as Mike just pointed out? Are there recovery programs, and what are they doing? Are there opportunities for people to have housing when they come out of treatment? Are there opportunities for people to have gainful employment as they proceed through recovery? And then one that we often forget about, but is the other significant tragedy of the opioid crisis, is are there less children being taken from their homes and put in state custody or living with grandparents or other family members because of neglect, because their own parents are too steeped in their own disorder to be effective parents? So these are all kinds of outcomes that, if you think about them, each one lends itself to a whole host of strategies and shows the need for such a comprehensive program in every state.
Sure. And you're articulating the fact that this is not only a clinical issue, it's a public health issue, and it's also a social issue as the supports that need to be in place in order to ensure successful recovery go far beyond the clinical.
Yeah, and David, I think that's where there's a lot of need that for conversation, because that's something that not a lot of folks go to right away when they think about the opioid crisis. They think about the high school athlete who treated for pain and then became addicted, or you know, some of the other stories that you hear more of. But in fact, one of the things we wanted to make sure we highlighted in the article were those social determinants of health, because as we look at recent history in America, we've always had a problem with drugs and addiction. And so if we're going to go substance by substance or molecule by molecule, I think we're going to have, again, this real siloed approach. Part of what we wanted to do with the paper was talk about a comprehensive approach for substance misuse and addiction, really focusing on opioids because that's where there's so much attention. But you know, there's plenty of application of the elements to work to prevent alcohol addiction or meth use and some of the other substances that we see folks using.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. We see a cycle of these issues over the years as public health issues, as public safety issues as well. And over time, it seems that there's much more of a piecemeal approach, sort of substance by substance or molecule by molecule, as you say, and it would make sense to deal with it on a broader basis. So on the,
just to illustrate how that's playing out, here in Vermont, the governor has an opioid coordination council, and the final report is coming out in December, and a marijuana advisory commission, because though we've legalized marijuana, there are questions coming up about developing a taxation and regulation system, et cetera. And so the report from that commission is coming out in December as well. And I've been heavily involved in the education and prevention components of both of these efforts. And the decision has already really become self-evident to everyone that there's going to be tremendous alignment on the recommendations. The recommendations are not going to be opioid specific or marijuana specific. They're going to be substance use specific, which is, you know, the evidence basis for most of what it happens in prevention is across substances. It doesn't have to single out one or another.
If you're just tuning in, this is Harlow on Healthcare, coming to you on Healthcare Now Radio. I'm David Harlow, and my guests today are Michael Fraser, PhD, CEO of the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials, and Mark Levine, MD, Vermont's Commissioner of Health. Gentlemen, how can health data or health IT help? I mean, specifically, how high of a premium would you put on data coordination and interoperability? My sense is that while there are these PDMP programs at various levels of maturity in different states, it is not clear to me that the various states' programs are necessarily using consistent data structures or that they're talking to each other. Do you have any insight on where we are on that trajectory of interoperability?
I can say that you're right. If you've seen one PDMP, you've seen that state's PDMP. So there is variability across states. I can also say that we are making great efforts, at least from the standpoint of bordering states, to make sure that there's adequate communication. So, for instance, Vermont borders on New Hampshire, New York, and Massachusetts, and the PDMPs do have the ability to talk to one another, so that you can find out if somebody living on part of the border is actually crossing that border and getting their prescriptions there, or perhaps seeking their care there, either for valid, genuine reasons or for less glamorous reasons because they can't get their care in the state they started in because they've been doctor shopping. So that element is starting to occur, which is really nice.
But my sense is that we don't have the ability, say, at the SAMHSA level or DEA level to look at a coordinated picture across 50 states.
That's true. And part of the issue is, as you mentioned in the introduction, you know, we got 50 state laboratories. We like to talk about 59 states and territories, all of whom make different decisions. And so it does create some technical challenges in terms of data standards, but also in terms of compiling data. One of the things we've really been pushing nationally is a common definition of overdose and how that's reported, because states have different coroner and medical examiner systems. And even within the same state, you might have smaller towns with coroners and larger cities with medical examiners. And so there's a tremendous need to shore up some standardization in terms of definitions. And then there's definitely a lot of urgency around more timely reporting of data. It's almost December 2018, and the report came out yesterday from CDC with the most recent overdose data that CDC had from the states, which was going back to 2017, which, given some of the prior research that we've been looking at, numbers were from 2016. So, I mean, a year ago, the epidemic was different. And so we're really looking at what can we do, you know, more real time, even looking at proxy data specific to overdoses. And, you know, clearly the PDMPs have a lot of applicability in terms of surveillance and more real time data. But some of the overdose deaths in particular and timeliness of reporting is a challenge across the states. The other place where there's a tremendous amount of opportunity, and it's a patchwork right now, is linking PDMPs to electronic health records in physician offices and health systems. And right. You know, clearly there are great systems out there that folks are using where the PDMP will just pop up during a consultation and, you know, physician can look at notes and as well as the PDMP. That's great. Not every state has that, unfortunately. And, you know, there's a real need to look at, you know, how these PDMPs fit into the workflow of a practice for the clinical decision making that needs to take place. But also, you know, can we do a better job tying those to public health surveillance and using those data for public health surveillance, which, again, right now in some places depends almost wholly on physician reporting to the state. And every state does this differently and has different challenges.
I would just add to that. First of all, I would validate everything Mike says, completely agree. But the one area our paper didn't spend a lot of time on, because it wasn't meant to, was on law enforcement. And I find that the partners that we have in law enforcement are even more demanding than some of our healthcare-associated partners when it comes to interoperability of data, because they do view themselves as having a very significant role in this crisis and in trying to stem the supply of drugs that are always coming in over state borders. And their ability to communicate well and have data interoperability with other states and supply routes is critical to their efforts. They've really tried to hold us to a higher standard, if you will, because of their needs.
Well, speaking of demanding partners in law enforcement, the U.S. attorney in Boston, Andrew Lelling, came out with letters that he sent to prescribers identified as having prescribed opioids within 60 days of death or where patients died of an opioid overdose. Just to remind prescribers that it's illegal to prescribe opioids, and I quote from his statement, without a legitimate medical purpose, substantially in excess of the needs of the patient, or outside the usual course of professional practice. My personal observation is to ask whether this is a reasonable approach or too much of a strong arm tactic. I mean, he's not necessarily accusing anyone of an improper prescription in any particular case, but using the occasion of a patient's death to send out a pretty strongly worded notice to prescribers that they need to be careful out there. Do you see that as a productive line of intervention?
I'm a little skeptical, as I sense in your tone as well, regarding that. I will say that we have found, both at our major academic medical center, but also through an innovation in our PDMP, that providing de-identified aggregate data to physicians and other prescribers is very helpful. People don't want to be an outlier in their prescribing habits. And if you can provide them with specialty-specific data on opioid prescribing that allows them to look at their own performance matched against those in their specialty, they quickly understand if they are or they are not an outlier in their practice. The same thing has happened within medical groups at our medical center. And so the physicians there know that they may be physician C on a tabular representation of data that has physicians A through X on it, and they're the only ones that know that they're physician C, so they get to look at what the average habits are and where the outliers are. I think physicians have always been provided that data for other drugs, usually through pharmacy benefits programs and insurers who want to make sure that there's a cost-effective approach to prescribing.
Right, I've seen that in the past in that context.
Yeah,
in the context of managed care contracting and
exactly what kind of drugs
are adhering to their formulary requirements and so forth.
Right. And this is now pretty much the first time it's actually been just look at your habits in general. We don't care what opioid it was. We just care that it was a prescription opioid and see if you match up or not. So the self-policing component to medical practice is alive and well.
There's legitimate concerns about legislating medicine when it comes to day limits or other kinds of activities, but we got to find the right balance here with the professional societies. I think by now, I would hope pretty much anybody who's prescribing, whether it's a physician or a dentist or a nurse practitioner, depending on the state, understands what their state guidelines are and what the professional society guidelines are. But there's continued need to reinforce those. We haven't taken a position as us, though, because states came to us and said, please don't legislate or set definitions nationally where there may be need for some flexibility or different kinds of standards. So this, again, it'll be a state-by-state approach. How states take their overdose death data, what they do with that, what they do with PDMP data, that's all varied as well, you know, in terms of what sets that off and what happens when there's an aberration. Sending a stern letter to somebody that may be over, there may be a legitimate reason why someone has a lot of pain patients or other kinds of issues in their patient population. But all those just need to be looked at. As Dr. Levine mentioned, you know, physicians do compare themselves and what their practice patterns look like. I would assume that more of that is going to help. But the other point to make, David, is that the more we tighten down on prescription opioids and access without really addressing the primary prevention of addiction, the more folks are turning to heroin and illicit opioids. And one of the most concerning pieces of data I saw recently was overdose rates going up primarily because of fentanyl, and fentanyl being used in heroin and folks not knowing and its potency. So, and again, all we're doing with PDMP isn't going to have anything to do with that. And in fact, some folks are saying it's actually pushing more people to illicit opioid use because they're unable to get prescription opioids.
I've seen that data in my own state where both of those things are true. There's a higher rate of overdose deaths and a much, much higher rate of those deaths being associated with illegal drugs.
I think that's the opportunity of this paper. And again, taking a public health approach, which is, let's look at the drivers of addiction. Let's look at the primary prevention of substance use disorder and think about those social determinants. I mean, we can deal with this issue clinically, and we can certainly try to expand treatment and should and get everybody into recovery. But really, the role that public health plays is working with the physician community and the healthcare community, as well as others in education and housing and employment, to address what folks have called these diseases of despair. And that's work of public health and partners. And we tried to lay that out in a comprehensive approach as well, so that this isn't just a medical problem. And certainly physicians and dentists and others who prescribe have a huge role in the epidemic and the crisis. We believe in public health that equal to that is some of these other issues. Folks need stable jobs and housing to feel hopeful and productive. Folks need to be educated and aware of all of the what's going on with this crisis, but also individually get engaged in communities. And public health has a huge role to play there. And I think that's where there's a lot of exciting opportunity.
Veering back to the more clinical for a moment, a number of healthcare institutions have gone on record over the past year saying, we're going to manage pain without opioids for our patients in the acute setting. And in addition, many chronic pain patients now complain that with state regulations limiting prescriptions to, say, a 7-day course, they're unable to get the treatment that they need to manage their chronic pain. And they're labeled as drug abusers through the PDMP programs in a way that's inappropriate. Do you have a perspective on whether cutting back on the use of these medications so dramatically is problematic in some situations and how that can be managed differently?
There's more and more compelling data coming to light that indicates that perhaps opioids are not the solution to every pain problem. There's even been literature in the emergency medicine literature that shows that for people who you would think would be suffering from a great deal of pain because they've shown up with a traumatic event or injury to an emergency setting, that use of common medications in combination, like ibuprofen, like acetaminophen, actually resulted in equal pain relief compared with a oral opioid. So the experiments are actually going on now more than ever to try to discourage the use of opioids when it should be discouraged. There are often opioids prescribed after surgical procedures, and within the realm of surgical procedures, there's a span from mild to moderate to significant procedures. But it turns out that even orthopedists who operate on joints are finding that when they offer their patients alternatives, pharmacologic medications that are not opioids, they're actually able to find that they can relieve their pain and are studying that now to try to create new protocols. One area that our country has not had as much work in as others is this whole notion of integrative pain management. And that involves drugs, but also non-drugs. So acupuncture, chiropractic, mind-body techniques, psychological training, a whole host of modalities done under one roof in a very integrative fashion. Piloting such approaches to pain management is now becoming more commonplace. We're seeing more and more of that kind of a trend, which can only be good for the profession and the public, for sure.
And that shift involves a lot of policy change. We have to look at what insurance will pay for and what's available in certain areas. But I would agree wholeheartedly that there's a need to explore these alternative treatments for pain beyond opioid. And really, the pendulum has swung in some places, I think, pretty far to the direction where it's hard for legitimate pain patients to get opioids, and they've been stigmatized. And I've heard anecdotes about that. I think they're very, very few. But I understand that, and certainly understand the physicians who are prescribing for those patients. But again, it's probably important we go somewhere in the middle here when we restrict access to opioids, because we don't want to deal with some unintended consequences for those folks. But we have not, as Dr. Levine said, really had this conversation nationally about tolerating pain in particular. In fact, started treating pain as the vital sign. And right. that's created this perception that all pain can be treated and eliminated. And there's lots of conversations about why pain happens and what that healing process is and why that's important. So I think we'll see more of that over time, especially as payers start promoting alternative treatments and there's more of that available to patients.
What we're seeing now is the institution of prescriber rules throughout states or guidelines, but they all incorporate a patient education session, if you will, a discussion that never used to happen in medical care before. It was almost an expectation that you would receive your prescription for a pain medication, possibly an opioid, and you would utilize it because that was state-of-the-art practice. Now, people are provided with a menu of options, and there is necessary communication, often accompanied by an informed consent process that's mandated, either legislatively or in practice, so that people actually have the chance to say, maybe I don't want that drug. Or if they're the prescriber, I personally don't think you need to have this drug for your management of your pain, and here's what I can offer. So that's a whole different level of conversation that did not occur routinely in medical practice until now.
Right. That's a whole different kind of conversation and requires a whole different kind of vocabulary and engagement with the patient. And some patients are open to that and others are not. Well, I have one last question for you, gentlemen. This is our lightning round. If you were to wake up 5 years in the future, what is one thing in healthcare that you would hope or expect to be different?
I can give you an answer that maybe you've not heard before. Mike won't be surprised by my answer. As a nation, we are unlike other what are termed developed nations that seem to have much better health outcomes than we do, no matter what metric you care to choose, whether it's life expectancy, maternal death, in pregnancy, infant mortality, you name it. Perhaps if we could begin to spend a greater share of our healthcare dollars on public health, prevention, and social services, much like these other developed nations do, rather than on healthcare itself, we would have less of a problem that we're talking about today with the opioid crisis, since we've emphasized with you and your listeners that so much of that emanates from the so-called social determinants of health and are not remediable by medications or operative procedures. They're more remediable by addressing the circumstances that people live in.
Thanks, Mark. Mike?
I'd love to see, similarly, wake up in 5 years and really see a health system that pays for prevention instead of sick care, and that's a value that we all hold in our healthcare system. And certainly look at incentives. The system we have isn't sustainable now, and we're not getting the outcomes that we want.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. This has been a pleasure.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
You have been listening to Harlow on Healthcare. Join us at healthcarenowradio.com. Let's continue the conversation on building the future of healthcare together at #HarlowOnHC. I'm David Harlow, keeping the fire going and holding a seat open for you. Until next time.